Hey, Sentinel Radio listeners, we've got some bonus content for you. In addition to our normal news gathering activities here in Washington, D.C., the two Sams are also surveying the political races around the country looking for leftists who are vying for office, whether they're trying to unseat Republicans or corporate Democrats. Today, we take you to Indiana's 9th Congressional District, a seat currently held by Republican Trey Hollingsworth, but not for long if our next guest has anything to say about it. Dan Cannon is a musician, a civil rights attorney, and now he's running for Congress. And he took some time out of his campaign to chat with the two Sams. Okay, off the bat, Dan, you are a musician. You're a civil rights attorney. You're not a politician. This is your first foray, really, into politics. So what are your politics?
I guess how do you answer that question in a concise way?
Well, you're talking to two very far left leaning people. Let's set Bernie Sanders as the benchmark. Are you to the left of him? Are you around where he's at? Do you find yourself a little bit more moderate than he is?
Yeah, I don't know, man. I'm not a political scientist, and I haven't really been involved in party politics before this stuff. So it's kind of hard for me to gauge that.
That's fair.
I think that there's some stuff that I'm to the left of Bernie on. I'm sitting here struggling trying to think of anything that I'm to the right of him on. it all is kind of in the eye of the beholder, isn't it? It depends on who you ask.
Yeah, sure. I mentioned your background as a civil rights attorney. You were involved in the Obergefell versus Hodges decision?
Yeah, uh-huh, which is the marriage equality case. That was the consolidated case, is called by the name Obergefell at the United States Supreme Court, but it was actually from four different states, so Ohio, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Michigan.
And what sort of work did you do on that?
Well, I was lead counsel for the Kentucky plaintiffs in that case, so we sort of saw the case through from the time it was filed up until we won at the Supreme Court. And I think it was one of those things of when it was filed in 2013, it was right after an opinion called Windsor versus United States, where the court said that the federal government had to recognize marriages in states where marriage was where same-sex marriage was valid and legal, and so we had figured it was just a matter of time before the dam broke and the Supreme Court said that you got to have marriage equality in the states. We litigated that case all the way through, and kind of lots of ups and downs along the way, but luckily everything turned out okay.
Last week, we just saw a Democrat flip a deeply red district in Pennsylvania, where Trump had won by 20 points. Connor Lamb managed to flip that from R to D. I know every congressional district has its own quirks, but I was just wondering if you took any lessons from that whole contest.
Well, I think that there's a danger in being overconfident about these things, right? So we keep seeing that, we hear talk about the blue wave or the blue tsunami or whatever people call it. You're seeing these successes happen with what we think is at least partially is a response to Trumpism. But I don't think that we can get overconfident about our chances in November. And I think what we really is incumbent upon the left to do right now at this point in history is to step up and to offer the American people a positive agenda for the future and say, this is what we're about. This is why you should vote for us. And it's not just because Trump is a horrible monster, which he is, but it's because we've actually got a plan for the future that involves people not going bankrupt or dying because they can't pay medical bills, and involves not saddling our kids and grandkids with a lifetime of tuition debt. It involves having, clean air to breathe and clean water to drink and all this good stuff. I think it's important that we not get too distracted by those victories, and that we keep hammering away on, I think, what is positive messaging for the future of America.
In addition to that, you're also running against this guy named Trey Hollingsworth, who you'll probably be focusing on a bit too in the campaign. For those in our audience who don't know who Trey Hollingsworth is, the guy who's currently holding the seat you're running for, who is he?
Well, he's a multimillionaire that comes from multi-generational wealth, that has never lived in Indiana before, maybe never set foot in Indiana before 2015, and I think it's one of those things where you see this phenomenon on both sides, really, of people shopping for districts that they can buy. And that's exactly what happened here. He managed to spend enough money on advertising to buy a Republican primary out from establishment Republicans here in Indiana in 2016. And they were looking at several different districts, you know, to go in and buy, and they managed to buy this one. And then he rode that Trump wave to victory. And, you know, a lot of good candidates lost in Indiana because of that Trump wave. And, you know, you now have this situation, which is not unlike what's going on in a lot of the rest of the country, and particularly the Midwest and South, where you've got somebody that is a rich guy that has been put into office by wealthy donors and special interests, and exists solely to solve rich guy problems. I mean, those are the people that put him in office, and so why should he, you know, attend to the needs of the regular folks that actually comprise the 9th District? And that's what you've seen out of his tenure, and out of the tenure out of a lot of other congresspeople, for a long time now, where there is not really much cognizance of, the real stuff that's going on. Is not, you know, any kind of willingness to solve the opioid crisis, which Indiana has been hit really hard by. There's not any willingness to sort of solve, you know, the healthcare issues that come up everywhere in the district. There's not certainly no willingness to solve the gun violence problem. And so you have a situation where, you know, it is really just a rich guy solving rich guy problems. And that's what he's been doing. And I think the people in my district, I've been here for more than 30 years. You know, I think the people in my district deserve better than that. They deserve to have real solutions to the stuff that they're going through every day.
One way Americans have been able to fight back against rich guys who are the tools of other rich guys has been labor unions. If I understand things correctly, you are in favor of repealing Taft-Hartley, the last major revision to the National Labor Relations Act. So how do you think labor law should be structured in this country? What are some of your ideas on that front?
Well, so it needs to be more favorable to allowing employees to organize and to be able to have some sort of recourse for employers who retaliate against employees who try to organize. You know, it's one of the things that there was a moment, I think, at the beginning of the Obama administration where Employee Free Choice Act could have been implemented, and that would have made it a lot easier for people to organize in the unions, and made it a lot more difficult for employers to retaliate against people for workers for trying to organize. So that's something that if we get control back of Congress, should be one of the top priorities. I think the Congress under Obama made healthcare a priority, and it's, you know, easy to kind of look back and say, well, you know, that was the right call or the wrong call, and sort of armchair quarterback that decision. But I do think that it should move. If we can really get control of the House and the Senate, that should move up in our list of priorities, along with strengthening the National Labor Relations Act and giving that some more teeth. And strengthening OSHA, giving that some more teeth, and, you know, making sure that we do stuff like protecting Davis-Bacon. And you know, the big thing that's lost in this conversation a lot, I feel like, is protecting the federal judiciary. So if you look at what's going on right now with the Supreme Court, they're getting ready to issue this catastrophic opinion in a case called Janus versus Ask Me, where almost everybody, pundit that watches the court is pretty sure that the court is going to essentially gut public sector labor unions with this opinion. And this is a result of, this sort of consistent installation of justices on the Supreme Court and judges at lower court levels that are very far to the right and have shifted the court way, way, way to the right. And so, they're sort of slowly chipping away at this law that was established by sane jurists in the 1970s and before. So you get these sort of monstrous results like we're going to get in Janus. We're at a situation now where labor unions used to, 30, 40 years ago, used to comprise a third of the workforce, and now we're down to 11%. And this opinion is going to knock it down even further. I mean, the good news is that you see some successes on the ground, and we should be talking about those and, encouraging that kind of stuff, like what we saw in West Virginia. That's a huge, huge success. And we should be publicizing that. We should be talking about that on the campaign trail and sort of encouraging that sort of organization and trying to replicate those successes in other places.
You mentioned EFCA, Employee Free Choice Act, in 2009, I believe. Well, there was a majority of House members who co-sponsored the legislation, had a majority co-sponsors. Nancy Pelosi never brought it up. I believe she was saying that it would never pass the Senate, which may or may not be true. But it basically what I'm wondering is, what are your thoughts on Democratic leadership in Congress? Do you see them as an impediment to a lot of these ideas you're talking about? Or do you think they sort of can see the writing on the wall and will sort of come around?
Well, I guess we'll see. I will say that I'm not terribly encouraged by what I've seen, happen in some of these other races around the country. And I mean, the most notable, I'm working with the organization that you guys, I'm sure, are aware of called the Justice Democrats. One of the other Justice Democrats endorsees down in Texas, Laura Mosier in Texas 7, I think. There was this situation where the DCCC essentially just smeared her for no apparent reason. And I think that, that level of interference in races that are out in the states, races in places like Texas and places like Indiana or Kentucky or Ohio or wherever, Illinois, it's going on too, is probably not a good idea. I'd like to see a little bit more of letting those races play out on the ground where they are, less sort of, what tends to be perceived as thwarting of progressive candidates by the DNC and the DCCC.
You're also running in the primary against Liz Watson. Have you encountered similar resistance forces?
There is definitely a dichotomy between what's going on in D.C. and local politics in a place like Indiana or a place like, in the Midwest. So, I think what we see is, what I've seen firsthand over the last year of campaigning is that, Washington sort of does its thing. And Indiana does its thing, I think that there is a perception by folks in D.C. About what is going to go, what kind of candidates and what kind of platforms and what kind of positions are going to play in a place like Indiana, and that perception is often not grounded in reality. Especially to those of us that have spent our entire lives here on the ground and in the district in Indiana. So, I say all that to say that what may look like a sort of picture perfect DC candidate from a DC perspective is not necessarily what's going to go well in the district or be the most viable candidate in the general.
Are you shockingly saying that people aren't excited by Evan Bayh?
Yeah, I mean, Evan Bayh is a really stark example of that. I mean, you know, because there is a guy who really, I mean, for most of his career and most of his life was Indiana through and through, right? And, you know, a little bit of time in D.C., and they were able to very successfully paint, you know, the right was very, able to very successfully paint Evan Bayh into a corner of being this sort of beltway insider. And, you know, I don't know how much of that criticism was undeserved and how much of it was fair, but it certainly was successful.
I want the audience to know that you also support healthcare as a human right, which is increasingly becoming a litmus test for Democrats, or should be at least for Democrats running in the future. I want to ask you a question that should also, or at least Sam and I are hoping, is a litmus test for Democrats in the future, and that is where you stand on eliminating or defunding ICE.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I think I was the first congressional candidate to come out very strongly and openly in favor of abolishing ICE. And it has a lot to do with my background, you know, working with immigrants and refugees in my capacity as a lawyer. You know, and I've seen what ICE is. I mean, like, I think most folks in the Midwest, it may be more, you may be more tuned into what ICE is doing in California or in New York or in D.C., but most folks in the Midwest don't really know what's going on in their own backyards. And I think if they did, they'd be outraged. I mean, you know, ICE essentially is a brute squad that exists to, you know, scoop up. At this point in history, it's they're here exclusively to scoop up peaceful people out of their homes and out of their workplaces and break up families and detain, you know, hardworking immigrants indefinitely. And you know, it's an organization that is basically devoted to serial human rights abuses. And they talk about people like they're objects, and they talk about people like they're animals. And I don't really feel like we need an agency like that. You know, we did just fine with immigration enforcement prior to 2001, and I think we can do just fine without ICE now. You know, we're spending a lot of money and a lot of resources to do a lot of bad things to people, and that just doesn't make sense.
Dan, you've been very generous with your time so far, and I know we could probably spend another 20 minutes on this subject alone, but I was just wondering if you might be able to quickly discuss your approach to foreign policy, just something that I was curious about.
A lot of people criticize Bernie Sanders for sort of having kind of blinders to the question of U.S. empire. We have seen since Bernie speak up about the U.S. involvement in Yemen and those sort of issues. But yeah, to the idea of U.S. empire in general and rolling back our military from around the world, where do you stand on that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that we should not get involved in armed conflict unless it's absolutely necessary to prevent a humanitarian crisis, you know. And then so the trick lies in trying to figure out what is a looming humanitarian crisis and what is not. You know, I think that just 40,000 foot view on foreign policy, and I'm by no means a foreign policy wonk here, but, you know, 40,000 foot view on that, I think we can do a lot of good on trying to get the working classes from, you know, different countries to communicate with one another in an effort to try to cut through propaganda. I mean, you know, propaganda is a hell of a drug. And, you know, the questions that I get at Bloomington and some of the, you know, the more liberal, the more progressive parts of the district is you're always asking about Israel-Palestine. Well, you know, like there's a lot about the folks, the Palestinian folks, the, you know, regular folks on the ground and the Israeli folks, regular folks on the ground, don't really know a whole hell of a lot about each other. And, you know, to the extent that we can foster communication between those folks on the ground and sort of cut through the propaganda that each one of the, well, that the Palestinian Authority and that the Israeli government is you know, propagating, is putting out there, you know, I think that the United States can play a role in doing that. Of course, we have our own propaganda machine to cut through here. And so that makes it all the more challenging. But, you know, I read someplace that the best statement on foreign policy is a very old one, which is workers of the world unite. So, you know, to the extent that we can get working class folks, ordinary folks, to talk to each other in countries where we would otherwise where we may potentially see conflict, I think that's a very useful foreign policy tool.
Yeah, definitely hear you on that last part. Dan, last issue I want to bring up with you. You mentioned your opponent, Trey Hollingsworth, how he was able to basically buy the district. What has that experience, plus just you running right now, taught you about the U.S. electoral process and our election systems? I know Democrats used to pay a lot of attention to things like voter fraud and voter ID stuff. A lot of that has been taken over by fears of Russia invading our elections rather than just standard GOP election meddling. But even beyond that, like from campaign finance to how we elect people in the United States, how have all these issues sort of kind of influenced your campaign and what changes you hope to make if you're elected?
Yeah, I mean, a lot. I think that people in general have a sense that the influence of money in American politics is something that's bad. And I think that until you run a race like this, you don't know how bad it is. I mean, I think however bad you think it might be, it's worse, right, for John Q. Public. And, you know, as I look at the situation, there are three big things that we need to address. One is just campaign finance reform overall, which is very difficult to address. I mean, that is a Gordian knot that is either going to take an executive who's willing to pack the Supreme Court or enough political will to impose a constitutional amendment. And that's a lot. So in terms of making meaningful progress on campaign finance, then you got gerrymandering, which is we're making some progress on that. And that Gill versus Whitford case that's hanging out in front of the Supreme Court might change, you know, sort of turn the tide on that issue. But what we can affect mostly on the ground is voter turnout. And in a place like Indiana, where, you know, our last primary, we were number 50 in the nation in voter turnout. We were dead last. And, you know, I think to the extent that candidates on the ground can affect this stuff, the best thing we can do is to try to affect voter turnout. And, you know, there's a variety of ways to do that, but I think that the simplest, most basic core way that we can do it is going back to what I talked about at the beginning of this interview, which is, you know, providing a positive agenda for the American future, telling people, like, look, this is the kind of country you can live in. We live in the wealthiest country in the history of the world. Here's what we can do with it, right? You know, here are the possibilities, and here's what I'm willing to do if I get put in office. You know, and you're seeing, I think, more recognition of that by progressives that are running on a Democrat ticket this time around, and hopefully it'll work, and you'll see even more of it.
Dan Cannon, running for Congress in Indiana's 9th District. Where can people find out more about your campaign or get involved?
Sure. Well, the website is www.canonforindiana.com, canonforindiana.com. And then you can look at Canon for Indiana, the Twitter account, or Canon for Indiana, the Facebook page.
Cool. Well, I encourage everybody to do that. Thanks for taking some time out of your campaign and day to chat with us about yourself.
Well, thanks for having me, Sam and Sam.
Yeah, thanks, Dan.
Thanks again to Dan, and thank you for listening. Be sure to subscribe to our Patreon for other sorts of bonus content, too. patreon.com/districtsentinel. We're in D.C., so you don't have to be.